Tyler, welcome back. You just got back from a conference.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time up in New Hampshire, actually, telling people all about Agene and the kind of resources we provide. A lot of them were surprised to learn how many educational resources we have.
Yeah, I mean, educational resources are a big part of what Agene does. A big part of my job, actually, is creating those protocol videos that you might have seen on our YouTube channel or our website. So it's always good to hear that people are interested in the educational resources that that we provide at Agene.
Yeah, and something that we don't often do is create things that are more directed towards high school students. But we're branching out and developing new collaborations with groups like the Journal of Emerging Investigators that we'll talk about today.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear how another nonprofit enables researchers.
In this episode of the Agene Podcast, we introduce you to the Journal of Emerging Investigators, an open-access journal that enables high school students to publish peer-reviewed scientific research. You'll meet some of the folks behind the journal and hear from a fantastic team of high school students who recently submitted to the journal with funding from Agene.
So thank you guys for sitting down with me and discussing the Journal of Emerging Investigators. Before I get into my questions about the Journal of Emerging Investigators, who are you guys?
I'm Mark Springle. I'm a graduate student at Harvard University and also president of Journal of Emerging Investigators.
Cool.
And I'm Olivia Hoshing. I'm an editor-in-chief at the Journal of Emerging Investigators.
Awesome. So I guess we've said Journal of Emerging Investigators a bunch of times already, but what is the Journal of Emerging Investigators?
So the Journal of Emerging Investigators is essentially a nonprofit project to give middle and high school students the experience of scientific publishing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, externally we are a science journal for middle school and high school scientists who might want to publish their work, but we think of ourselves as a science education program mm-hmm. to help give students an idea of what actually performing science as a real scientist is like.
Okay, cool. And how did JEI start? Like, who had the original idea for doing that?
Yeah, so JEI started in 2011 with several graduate students at Harvard Medical School who were volunteering at a local science fair and saw that a lot of the students who made these fantastic science posters at the completion of the science fair essentially threw their posters in the trash and moved on. And so their experience and their progression, through the scientific world ended when the science fair ended. Mm-hmm. And to our founders, that was really sad. And, knowing that science is really an iteration upon itself, you conduct an experiment, you get results, you do an analysis, and you develop new questions. They wanted to expose middle and high school students to that mm-hmm. and allow them to have that experience. And what better way than to write up your findings, receive feedback from professional scientists, maybe go back to the drawing board one or two times, and then publish your work as a finalized product that you can communicate with the world.
Sure. And so who were the founders? Who originally got it off the ground?
So Sarah Fankhauser was a graduate student in immunology and microbiology at the medical school. And she was the primary founder. And our two first editors-in-chief were Lincoln Pasquina mm-hmm. and Chris Wells.
Okay, cool. Actually, Lincoln was in the same graduate program that I was. So always interesting connections with people in science, I think. That's all sounds like an awesome idea, but I guess how did it all get off the ground, like in terms of funding and that kind of thing? Like, did the grad students just like take on all the work themselves, or were there outside partners? How did it all work?
So one of the amazing things about JEI is that we are 100% volunteer run. Mm-hmm. And so the funding that we do get basically goes towards operating our website and our manuscript platform mm-hmm. And different outreach events. And that funding generously comes from Harvard University, different outreach programs, some very private charitable donations, and also with the help of organizations such as Agene.
Okay, great. And so what is your guys' involvement with with JEI been like? I guess, how did you even get started with JEI, and how did you get into the positions that you have now?
Well, so I think we actually started the same year. Mm-hmm. So we went to a recruitment event, and the current editors-in-chief told us about the different manuscripts that had been published. One that was gaining a lot of attention at that time was this article about different font types.
Okay.
And how that affects the pricing of how much a school spends on their printing.
Huh,
and
okay.
So this really clever student figured out an experiment that he could do to figure out which font type would save his school money. And so that's what got me interested in JEI, that these students could actually figure out how to do an experiment and make it into something that would have a larger impact.
Sure. Has somebody put, like, the findings from that into action now, or...?
So I think their school definitely has, mm-hmm. and the student then wrote another article to sort of extrapolate it towards the government, how much the government could actually reduce their costs on printing,
mm-hmm.
And that story got picked up by CNN, and so I don't know if the government has since then done something
sure.
about it, but it's at least gotten out there.
Yeah, that's super cool. I guess that gets to another question. Before we go into your background, Mark, is kind of what kind of papers do you guys take in? What kind of work does the Journal of Emerging Investigators cover? Because I think of it as more of like a biology thing, because you guys are both biologists, but like having the font types is very different. So
yeah.
Does it cover everything? Or?
It is largely biology and chemistry. Part of it is just, you know, the science that students are doing in their school and what their teacher can help them
mm-hmm.
with, but... students are really creative in what they do. They've done psychology, sociology,
mm-hmm.
Physics.
Cool. So covering basically a ton of different stuff. From the editorial side, is it always easy then to edit all of that stuff when you don't necessarily have the expertise in that area? And what do you do to make yourself a better editor, I guess?
So it is a learning curve
mm-hmm.
that... As a graduate student to be an editor, you start out with manuscripts that it is in your field, and you learn how to critique those and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can grow from there. And for our review process, we've definitely pulled in reviewers last minute, asking them, just sending them the manuscript, seeing if they're interested in this. And in an academic environment, you can always find somebody
sure,
who's interested.
Okay, cool. And I'm sure they want to help the kids out, too.
Yeah.
So that's really good. And Mark, kind of how did you get into your position?
Yeah, so as Olivia was saying, we went to an introductory meeting, and I actually started as a copy editor
mm-hmm.
And kind of got involved with all parts of JEI through the years.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, I was involved in outreach. I was director of outreach. And then I became interested in expanding JEI through some special programs, collaborations with different outreach programs, developing a new online manuscript platform where students could submit their articles and see articles go through our process in a very transparent way.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually... you know, now I'm leading the organization, which is very different.
Yeah.
And sometimes I miss being an editor, but I try to get involved in various ways when I can, either reviewing or editing a paper where...
You still pluck in as a copy
pluck
editor.
In occasionally, yeah.
I guess when you have your hat as the leader of the organization, what kind of tasks are you doing?
At this point, it's mostly administrative. I try to keep everything running well. Also, trying to procure funding for the organization. So we're really rapidly growing. We're
mm-hmm.
receiving more manuscripts than ever. We're expanding to universities across the country. So not only Harvard, but also MIT, Tufts, Rutgers, Stanford, UCSF,
mm-hmm.
Emory, among others.
Cool.
And so, you know, with that, we've been trying to create new partnerships with these schools, as well as partnerships with other outreach organizations, and partnerships with other nonprofits interested in outreach to try to get the message out and really try to get the message to students and teachers that science is something that's incredibly accessible, and it doesn't have to be something that's restricted to a lab environment, and publishing doesn't have to be something that's restricted to a professional environment.
Yeah.
That anyone can do it and anyone can get engaged, and this is part of what inspires us as scientists,
mm-hmm.
just the ability to ask questions that we find interesting and then share our findings, you know, with the rest of the community.
Yeah, definitely. So it's awesome that you're kind of branching out far beyond Harvard now. I guess when JEI first started, how did you guys, or I guess you weren't directly involved, but how did JEI itself solicit people to actually start publishing with you, and how do you still do it now? Like, how do you get people interested?
It was really originally just through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so starting off at Harvard, our editor team was basically Sarah and Lincoln and Chris and their close friends. And they spread the word throughout the community for anyone who'd be interested in this new science outreach experiment, really. Mm-hmm. And they also solicited advice from teachers that they knew,
mm-hmm.
Either family members who were teachers or friends. They went to science festivals. They went to teachers' conferences to try to spread the word. And so it began very locally,
mm-hmm.
But then gradually expanded to, you know, now where we have editors all over the country and manuscripts coming in from all over the world.
Cool. And so I guess how many manuscript submissions do you guys get now, like say per month or something like that?
So it varies over the school year, so you can sort of tell when students are working on something, and then they write it up nearly like the end of the semester or the end of the year. So at peak, we get maybe 20 to 30
wow, yeah,
manuscripts.
Do all of, them kind of go through the whole process, or do you get people dropping off throughout, or...
So we accept all manuscripts,
mm-hmm.
Pending certain revisions.
Mm-hmm.
So with the initial submission, if students have trouble with just the basics of how to write a scientific paper, then we'll give them basic feedback on
mm-hmm.
how to do that and send that back.
Yeah.
So we see drop-off there. But often students will just resubmit, and then they'll go through the scientific review process. They'll get feedback from expert scientists in their field, and then some students at that point will choose not to go forward. They just don't have time or support.
Sure, yeah.
Or they'll work on the revisions and then resubmit.
Mm-hmm. So when you're doing that initial step of kind of helping them even write the actual manuscript in the first place, what form does that feedback take? Is it just kind of like a lot of emailing back and forth? Do you do like video conferences or anything like that? How do you help people out?
It's a lot of emailing back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So as editor-in-chief, then we collect the feedback from the editorial team, and then we send that to the authors. We'll go back and forth. There's always a senior mentor, so an adult that's working on the manuscript with the student.
Mm-hmm.
So even if feedback is maybe too tough for just a student alone to work with, then we'll try to speak more with the senior mentor so that they're actually getting the support they need.
Sure, yeah. And what kind of stuff do reviewers ask the students to do as part of the review process?
So there are nearly always, you know, writing presentation changes that they
mm-hmm.
recommend.
Yeah.
For scientific changes, often it will just be, oh, maybe you should do this a few more times. You know, reproducibility is very important in science.
Yeah.
Suggestions on how they can do their analysis, since a lot of students haven't really done statistics or really learned how to interpret data, then this is
mm-hmm.
A great opportunity for them to really dive into it.
Yeah.
And then some changes if the student really can't make it, if they just don't have access to the equipment they need or so forth, then we at least try to help them to think about what it would mean for them to do something further. And
mm-hmm.
then they discuss that more in their manuscript
mm-hmm.
so that there's still a scientific learning process on top of written revisions.
Sure, yeah, that all sounds really awesome. And in the end... I guess what kind of percentage of people end up going through that whole process?
Publication is...
Yeah, so in the end, probably about 30% of
okay.
all submitted
yeah.
manuscripts
yeah.
Get published. And that's something that we've been trying to bring up.
Yeah.
So what we found is a real struggle, and one of the reasons why we're trying to make more partnerships with different outreach organizations, schools, is that a lot of teachers... don't have so much experience, you know, in science writing or conducting research,
mm-hmm.
And because we're not in the classroom working directly with students, sometimes it's difficult to write feedback in a way that the student is immediately going to understand and know what to do.
Sure.
So we've created new programs where students can have a mentor from JAI that works with them one-on-one, mm-hmm. in addition to the associate editor that works with them. We also are creating more partnerships directly with teachers, mm-hmm. to try to inform teachers of the expectation. But one thing that we do require from all students is that they work with a senior author, mm-hmm. Who can be a parent, a teacher, a laboratory mentor, who will submit the article. Mm-hmm. And this way, that senior author is privy to all the correspondence that goes back and forth between us and the student, and can help the student work through a lot of the feedback that we mean just to be constructive, but to the student who might have never gone through this process before,
yeah.
it can be kind of daunting.
Yeah, definitely. And so are the people that you are trying to pair, kind of the expert mentors that you're trying to pair them up with, are they local to the students, or are they kind of like other grad students that would be at Harvard or something like that?
So the senior authors are, they're chosen by the students, so mm-hmm. that's their most local mentor.
Mm-hmm.
The mentors that we recommend are often reviewers or their senior editors.
Mm-hmm.
So they're usually from Harvard or some other university.
Mm-hmm.
So they can have a closer correspondence with the student.
To
work with them.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like you guys are getting them a ton of resources, which is really great. And for the final products that come out, I guess, who do you expect to be your target audience for the papers that get published? And I guess, do you know how popular JEI is and how much viewership you get? Or readership, I suppose, would be better.
Yeah, so our target audience for the finalized articles are mostly students who are interested in conducting their own science experiments, and so they might read through articles on JEI, which is written at their level,
mm-hmm.
Experimenting, with ideas, that is, that are of interest to the students. And, we're also targeting teachers. So teachers who want to teach their students about science research or science writing, instead of just throwing nature papers in front of the students, which, might be written at a level they can't quite understand yet, or about science that is far too advanced, mm-hmm. for their level in school.
Yeah.
JEI articles are written at a, middle school or high school level science-wise, concerning science that the students might have already gone over in school and that's of interest to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiments themselves are less lofty, and so a student then can imagine themselves in the situation as the student who is writing the article that they're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And so science that way seems a lot more attainable.
Yeah. So a little bit later in this podcast episode, we do an interview with some students who actually submitted a paper to you guys, and it was published a few months ago, I think, now. And I guess they worked directly in a university-level lab as they were doing this work. How common is that versus people who are just kind of doing stuff maybe in their own house or even at their school, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's definitely becoming more and more common as more students get the opportunity to do summer internships or just meet faculty and work in a lab itself. Maybe it's about a third.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the other manuscripts are experiments that students did in the classroom with a teacher or did at home.
Yeah.
But even for summer internships and working in a real laboratory, I think JEI is a great opportunity for the grade school student to be able to take ownership of that,
mm-hmm.
of their experience, and actually get more out of it and think about it further and maintain contact with that lab. So
yeah, definitely. So do you guys help set up partnerships like that, or do these things just kind of people submit stuff to you and you're kind of surprised to see that happens?
At one point in time, we did set up internships with labs at Harvard University.
Mm-hmm.
But recently we've been trying to focus more on the mission of, giving students an excellent publication experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so providing some external feedback,
mm-hmm.
That's, apart from their main mentor.
Sure. Because
if we want to mimic the professional publishing process, we're going to be essentially external reviewers. JEI is different because we're on the student side, and we don't outright reject any articles unless they're plagiarized or they don't actually describe experiments. But even in those cases, an editor-in-chief like Olivia would then talk to the students about what an experiment is and how they could take their project and turn it into something that's hypothesis-based and where they're testing something.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to focus then on the publishing process itself.
Okay, cool.
In that same line, these research experiences are great when a student gets to go into lab, but I think for the mission of JEI, we do want to encourage that students can really do science anywhere. Mm-hmm. They can figure out how to design an experiment and do it at home. They can encourage other students in their class to do an experiment with them. So we wouldn't want to just encourage, students to get into, institutional labs in order to do research.
Yeah. So it's kind of a democratization of science in some ways, which is really good. And you bring up the mission of JEI. I'm going to read the mission out loud just because I have it here. It's a little bit easier that way. But you guys say on your website, we support young scientists in developing and answering their own scientific questions. We evaluate the work of young scientists and guide them in thinking critically about their research and communication. We provide the opportunity for young scientists to fully engage in the scientific process by publishing their research through an open access and free journal. So I guess, how do you assess your impact based on your mission? How do you go about seeing whether or not you're doing a good job of evaluating students and whether they really are becoming more engaged through JEI? How do you figure out whether or not you're successful?
So I think one of the most powerful things about JEI is that we have very clear phases of publication and very clear review phases that we take students through.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are four major phases. One is the pre-review phase. One is the review phase. The third is the copy editing phase. And the final one is the publication phase.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess going through that mission statement, we think that the pre-review phase, which is conducted by the editors-in-chief, really tackles with the prospective authors the large ideas of their experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Have you formatted your manuscript in a way that is representative of a professional manuscript, but also the experiments that you describe? Are they experiments that have a hypothesis, something that you're able to test? Do you have results? Broadly, are your ideas in line with something that, can be reviewed by a journal? The review phase is when we send out the article to three or four professional scientists in the field of that student. And during this phase, the student's science gets critiqued by professionals in the field. And so we're connecting then students who are in middle school and high school with other students who are in graduate school. And so we call it peer review in a sense because, there are students talking to students, and so
sure,
that's relatable. But also here are students at a much higher level who are more specialized in the field. And for many middle school and high school students, this might be the first time they've interacted at all,
mm-hmm,
with someone with a PhD or someone who does science research.
Mm-hmm.
The copy editing phase is one where after all the science has been thought about and finalized and perhaps the student's analysis now includes statistics and they've really thought about their results in context of the field at large, the copy editing phase is one where we give them tips on writing in a more engaging way. Of course, we correct for typos and grammar mistakes, and we try to round out then their writing into something that can be engaging to a general audience while getting across the main points that they want to communicate. And finally, the publication or proofing stage is one where we will take their manuscript, put it into a professional format, show it to the student, and work with them to, format the manuscript with figures in a way that you know, once again, best communicates their science and that the student approves of. Mm-hmm. And so the student then is involved in each one of these stages. And at each stage, we see the tremendous improvements, you know, in not only the student's writing and their ideas, but also their, you know, understanding of what science is and what science communication is.
Sure. So in part, you can see kind of the success of the mission on the individual level when you're seeing how the manuscript changes. Have you done anything like, I guess JEI has been around for, I don't know, what, like maybe 7 or 8 years now, something like that. Gone back and seen where the students have gone since then, do more of them go into science than, say, like the general public or something like that?
Yeah, so now that JEI has been going on for a while, we can now follow up with older students that have published with us, and that's what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. We're having interviews and doing surveys of past authors to see where they are now, and a good amount of them. So it is a little bit of self-selection. If
sure.
you already,
yeah.
if you are doing a science project in high school, you're probably already interested in for college.
Yeah.
So they at least are entering college wanting to do science and more enthusiastic about it, at least from their own reports. I think it'll be really interesting to see the impact of JEI to follow with their future publications and see how maybe their interests since when they published with us have developed further. So that's a work in progress.
Yeah, that's exciting stuff. I'd love to hear about it when you guys learn what the impacts are for sure. And kind of along those lines, so you're doing that as part of JEI's future development, kind of learning more about impacts. What other things do you see in JEI's future? Do you see the mission changing further in any way? Are there particular initiatives that you're super excited about?
So we're really trying to get involved in the classroom.
Okay.
And so we saw an opportunity with our articles to create curriculum for teachers to use in the classroom to introduce science research and primary scientific literature, but also scientific writing. And so currently we're pursuing a few different avenues to take our articles and create either, you know, single-day activities for students where students would read an article, answer a few questions, and also think about what would be the next step in that series of investigations outlined in the article. But also, you know, longer programs, so 6-month or you know, even several year programs that would gradually take the students through several JEI articles, you know, of advancing difficulty, and then, you know, in a final year, a capstone project would be coming up with their own scientific, you know, project that would build on the articles they read, and then finally publish with us. The results of an experiment they conducted.
Sure. And Olivia, any things that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I'm more excited for the one-on-one mentorship and developing the writing coaches and science coaches.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure where that will lead, because that also involves getting reviewers and more senior scientists staying in JEI for a longer time. But I think the enthusiasm is there to sort of have mentors that follow these students longer.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was one thing that I was going to ask. So being that the organization is mostly grad student run, do you have difficulty kind of maintaining the same level of interest from grad students over, like, I guess probably not over the last 6 years or so, but now that you're kind of getting into a phase where you're going to have turnover of people, or you already have had turnover, is it difficult to keep the organization going?
Well, so our reviewers can be graduate students. They're also, you know, postdocs and professors and teachers and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So reviewers actually stay with JEI for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
There's more turnover with editors. They're editors as long as they're in graduate school.
Sure.
Sorry, I forgot what your question was.
Yeah, basically, how do you deal with the turnover that is inherent to grad students, being that you're a grad student-run organization? I guess, like, how do you maintain institutional know-how and stuff like that as you want to keep developing as an organization but are still grad student-run?
Oh, I see. Yeah, so as far as the editors and maintaining the integrity of the editorial team through years, then we're working on more guidelines and training and so forth, and more discourse between editors so that they're learning from each other and from their experiences, and then actually recording that with us so that we can pass that on to more editors and the system actually grows and develops.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges you realize running an organization like this that perpetuates, or hopefully perpetuates for a long time past when we're here, is exactly that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's wonderful for us as graduate students to be leading this organization, because you come across so many challenges that you wouldn't see in your, you know, daily lab life, such as that. And so, you know, as Olivia was saying, we're trying to standardize practices, we're trying to create transition plans, such, you know, and also establish funding streams that will, you know, continue to support JAI into the future. Mm-hmm. When we have to hand over the reins. So it's a challenge, you know, definitely, especially, you know, when you're working with graduate student volunteers. But I think it's one that we have anticipated and we're trying to tackle right now.
Sure, and definitely worthwhile to face it, too. So I guess my final question for you guys is more personal for each of you. What do you want to do after grad school? You've been heavily involved with JEI, obviously. Do you want to keep going down that kind of route? What are your plans?
Yeah, I would love to stay in science publishing and work on communicating science for a more public audience. So I'd love to do something like National Geographic or NOVA or something that's mm-hmm. about science learning for a general audience.
Sure, yeah.
I see myself sitting in science research, but I think the tremendous thing about academia is that, you know, there's always time to, you know, to teach and to become involved, you know, with different outreach programs. And so science communication and teaching is something, you know, that I really enjoy and I plan to, you know, continue to be involved with in the future.
All right, great. Well, thank you guys for sitting down with us, and I'm excited to see where you end up, for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you guys tell me who you are? We'll go to each one of you first. Kind of like what your background is and how you ended up publishing in the Journal of Emerging Investigators. So whoever wants to answer first, I guess we could go from like my left to right. But
is that me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm J.I. Chen, and I've always enjoyed science from a young age. I found the biology class at school extremely interesting, and once we visited the planetarium, and the person told us that if our brain was as big as the sun, it would contain more energy, and that really got me into this whole biology field, I guess, but I've always been interested in science.
Okay, cool.
I'm Aruba, and I've also been interested in biology since the beginning. I guess my parents always took me to, like, museums all the time. Like, the New York Hall of Science is always my favorite place to go. And I, like, really liked reading, like, National Geographic articles when I was young. So that always got me, like, really into, like, biology and, like, the whole cells aspect.
Okay.
And I'm Jillian. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
And I'm Jillian. And, like Aruba and Jai-Chen, I've kind of always been interested in science from a young age. So, like, having this opportunity to work in the lab this past summer was really great. And then how we, like, got into publishing is the paper is that our mentor, he actually, like, approached us. Like, he found it online. He approached us and thought it would be a really good opportunity for us.
Okay, cool. And I guess how did you guys end up in the lab in the first place? Like, what got you involved with doing any kind of research?
All right. Well, our school had a research program, and we all demonstrated similar interests. And our teacher happened to know a professor at Stony Brook, and so we just happened to be paired together.
Okay, cool. So did you guys know each other beforehand? Had you worked together on anything before?
Well, Jai-Chen and I go to the same school, so we've known each other since the start of high school, but Jillian, we didn't know Jillian, so that was a good opportunity for all of us to get close.
Cool.
None of us were really close, but after this experience, we've really become friends.
Yeah. So you would say that was kind of like a benefit of working in the lab. You got to work really close to each other and kind of learn more about each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And so I guess before we go into a little bit about some of the things that you guys learn about lab work, I guess can you give me a quick rundown of what you learned science-wise? So I'm going to give you a kind of a challenge here. In 2 minutes, can you explain to me what your research project was and what you discovered? Maybe we could have one volunteer from the three of you, probably the best way to do it.
Okay, so for our project, we researched a protein called CCDC11, and this was previously associated with like cilia and centrioles, and specifically known to help establish like the proper placement of your organs, like in your chest and stomach area. And so from that, we looked at CCDC11 and its role during cytokinesis and cell division. And so we found that CCDC11 was actually necessary for cell division to occur. And without it, there was cellular defects such as binucleation and multinucleation. And we think that this may have implications in neurodegenerative diseases as well as viral budding and cancer research.
Okay, great. So you kind of covered everything that I wanted you to cover, which is awesome. But I guess as kind of a follow-up question, how did you guys first learn about CCDC11 in the first place? Was it just something that the professor was working on and he thought you guys might find interesting? Or did it take a little bit of convincing for you guys to end up working on this? Or did you learn about it on your own? What kind of thing?
Well, this protein first showed up when our professor was and another student was working with the Chibi pathway, and they thought that CCDC11 could interact with it. Mm-hmm. So then the previous students had an interesting observation that CCDC11 actually localized to a specific area. It's called the midbody when cells are dividing. And this is an important place where a lot of proteins involved in cell division are recruited to. So then that led us to want to explore more about this protein's role in cell division.
Okay, awesome. So it was kind of like building off of work that was already going in the lab and getting some other people's expertise to build into your project.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And I guess so how much of it was you guys kind of working on your own, and how much of it was you got ideas for what experiments to do from mentors in the lab, and also who were your main mentors in the lab?
Well, our main mentor was Dr. Takamaru, and he really helped us learn the different protocols, like immunostaining and all the different processes. He helped us, like, understand our results and, like, how to actually go through the entire process. But a lot of it was us doing the immunostaining, doing the transfection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So you guys got some real practical lab experience where you were doing protocols on your own. And I guess, so for you guys, was it your first time working in a biology lab, like a real research biology lab? And had you done, high school biology labs before that?
Well, like, we've done, like, labs in, like, our biology classes, but there's
sure,
nothing,
yeah,
like, working an actual, like, scientific lab. They're pretty basic.
Yeah, so what kind of things were easy for you and what kind of things were difficult? Let's go with easy. What was your favorite thing to do in the lab and that was just, like, it came naturally to you?
I think we all liked, like, looking at our slides underneath the microscope and then taking the images.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all, like, enjoyed that, just, like, seeing the different results that we got.
Yeah. So, I did research for a long time. It's kind of nice when you finally get a result of something. It gives you a little bit of a rush. It helps you get through some of the more tedious stuff that's a little more difficult. Would you guys agree that when you finally get to, like, look at a slide, look at a result, that would be your favorite part of it? Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I guess on the flip side of that, what would you say was the most difficult?
I think it was difficult to not always have an answer because in school we're used to being fed information and just regurgitating the information,
mm-hmm,
and having to come up with own ideas and not being able to always have this definite result was a little challenging. And also it required a lot of patience,
mm-hmm,
because there was a lot of waiting time in between steps.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess how long were you guys working in the lab throughout this whole project?
It's about, like, 6 weeks or so.
Okay. That's cool. I mean, 6 weeks to end up getting a result that you can actually get a paper published for is really awesome. I guess during that entire process, did anything surprise you?
I think our final result was definitely a surprise, and that was our result that CCDC11 co-localized with CHIM2A, and that was really what definitively told us that it had this role in cytokinesis, because up until then it was all theoretical that it may be involved, but like that was just like, wow, we really discovered something that has so many implications.
Mm-hmm. And I guess so you guys weren't expecting that result at all. Did that then kind of make you want to continue doing research because you got this thing that could have further implications?
Yeah, definitely. Because like after like seeing our hard work pay off and seeing this like result, we want to like explore more, especially since there's so much more we can do to like stain more cells, see and validate our results.
Mm-hmm. And so will you get the opportunity to do that in this lab, or will somebody else potentially be doing that?
Yeah, this coming summer, we're going to work together again, and we're hopefully going to continue this.
Okay, awesome. Another question that's kind of about the stuff that you did in the lab. What was the process like for you to decide that you needed to do those techniques? Did you kind of get somebody told you what techniques were available, and then you picked what you would be doing? Like, how involved were you in the actual design process for your experiments?
Well, since we obviously didn't have a lot of like lab experience, our mentor did kind of just like help us, guide us, and kind of tell us which direction to go with the experimental design.
Mm-hmm. But we planned the ordering of the antibodies.
Yeah.
So we kind of had the idea that, you know, we were looking for certain things, right? Mm-hmm. Pre-ordered all that stuff.
Sure, cool. So it was a little bit, I mean, that happens no matter what. When you're working with a mentor, it's always good to have somebody who can guide you into what experiment you're going to do. So that's really awesome that you guys kind of got to follow that through. And you got all the way to submitting to JEI, so the Journal of Emerging Investigators. And I guess, what was that process like? Did you guys know that you were going to be doing that from when you started working in the lab, or did it just come about because you got this cool result?
I think it only came about after we got the result, and the experience was actually really interesting. I don't think we expected to get that thorough of a feedback, and it was really exciting learning, I guess, some of the process and having to actually write back to the people who mm-hmm. edited.
Yeah. So what did you have to do in order to get the paper finally published?
Well, we had to make some like clarifications in some of our sentences and like our paper, and then we also had to add like some figures that they asked for, like maybe like a graph, and mm-hmm. That was it.
Cool. So you guys got some practice doing the actual writing and the showing of the data through figures. Did they also ask you ever to do like more experiments or anything like that?
No, it was really more just clarifying what we had and providing more, like, as Jillian said, more data, like, and so we were missing a graph that we actually had, or then we could add that in, or just, like, clarifying some different areas and just making sure that our results were clear.
Sure. And so what did you learn from that whole process?
It was really, like, how, like, if we were to become, like, real researchers and we would submit a journal for research for publication, I guess that was, like, kind of similar to the process. So it gave us, like, an idea, like, beforehand. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I guess from that whole process, do you also think that you understand biology and biological research better? I guess you did say it was very different from, like, anything you had done in a lab class or anything like that. But do you feel like you learned more about just biology in general by doing the research?
Yeah, I think we understood a lot more of what is not known. Mm-hmm. I feel like in school you kind of assume that, oh, people know everything, now we just have to go and memorize everything. But we kind of saw, like, we really don't know much about this world around us, and so that was really cool.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, some people don't realize that until the end of grad school, so that's really good that you figured that out now. So, yeah, based on the results that you guys got for your work that's in JEI, what kind of stuff do you want to do next summer, or could other people do?
The cancer line way, or the viral or the neural pruning. So,
Oh, I was going to say. Oh, I can do it. So we discovered, when we looked at staining of CCDC11, we actually looked at cancer. We didn't look at it, but we found we looked at
We looked at images from the human protein atlas and found that in hepatocellular carcinomas and colorectal cancers, they have high stainings of CCDC11. So we're thinking that next summer we want to look into the cancer cell lines and see the stainings of staining patterns of CCDC11 in them.
And what's kind of your hypothesis? Like, what might it show you?
In cancer cell lines, if CCDC11 may be upregulated, so maybe there's a higher amount of staining in cells that are like in cancer cell lines since they're proliferating at a faster rate. Mm-hmm. So possibly that.
And then we also want to. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. And then also when we were like formulating the paper and doing that, we also found that some of the machinery that we found to be associated with cell division is also involved in viral budding. So based on that, we've actually proposed like a viral budding model that will allow us to see if CCDC11 is involved in that process, and that could have very high implications for HIV-1 because viral budding is known to be a major process there.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about what viral budding is and why it's important?
Oh, okay. So, cell division and viral budding are both membrane scission events, and they involve the cutting of a membrane. So when viral budding occurs, it's basically the virus detaching itself from the membrane to proliferate.
Okay, so it's like making more virus using the cell membrane of whatever cell it's been proliferating in. And so you guys think CCDC11 might be involved in that process and could potentially be manipulated in the future one way or another?
Yeah.
Cool. So it sounds like, there's a lot of implications for stuff for CCDC11 that could have a lot of effects on different diseases. You talked about cancer, potentially HIV and other viruses. Is there any other stuff that you might be working on in the future that somebody else might be working on?
Well, we definitely want to continue the staining and look at CCDC11's localization patterns with other proteins. And we're also probably going to perform a live cell imaging to just observe the cytokinetic defect.
Okay, cool. So learning a little bit more about what its general biology is, knowing who it interacts with, so you can figure out maybe... That'll give you more ideas probably later and things that diseases or other phenomena that it could be involved with. It definitely sounds like a lot of exciting stuff that'll be coming out. And so even if you guys don't end up working on this, is there somebody in the lab who is ready to take it on?
Maybe not in the lab, but I think other students in our district might continue to work on the project after we're finished, or like simultaneously they'll take like a different part of the project and then we'll take another part and like simultaneously research it.
Sure. I guess I didn't ask this either. What year are you guys? Are you juniors, seniors, what?
Juniors.
Okay. So you still got a little bit more time that you could keep working on it if you needed to.
We're grateful that we got the opportunity to help these students gain early experience with scientific publishing through the Journal of Emerging Investigators. We will continue helping young scientists through our growing list of educational resources and future educational initiatives. To keep up to date on educational opportunities from AdGene, be sure to subscribe to the AdGene podcast and blog. AdGene, a better way to share science.